Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. My name is Dana Hill, and this is our weekly hour-long program devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. This week, we have a show where we're going to talk about something we haven't spoken about before, which is blood, and particularly transfusions. Animals sometimes require blood transfusions just like people do, and we're going to learn about how that is done. My guest from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Andrew Specht. I hope you can join us for Animal Airwaves Live coming up next here on Florida's 89.1 after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. My name is Dana Hill. This is our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. This week, I am speaking to the expert on blood here at the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Andrew Specht. We're going to learn a bit about blood and what it means to get a blood transfusion if you're an animal. Of course, human beings sometimes need blood transfusions, and many of us have donated blood. Well, animals do it too, and we're going to find out how that works. So first of all, welcome to the program, Dr. Specht. I'm glad to have you here. Can you describe to me, though, to get us started, the various functions of the blood, because we all know what blood looks like, and we know that we all have it, but I could tell you maybe what, you know, I know that there are white blood cells, I know there are red blood cells, I know that there's plasma, but I don't know exactly what everything does, and are the functions that those cells perform in human beings the same as what they perform in animals?
Yeah, so blood in animals is very similar functionally to blood in people, and it is, as you mentioned, comprised of, there's a liquid part of it, which is the plasma, and that has a lot of proteins mixed in, and then there's also a cellular component, so there are live cells in blood. Red cells make up the vast majority of those, and red cells' primary purpose is to carry oxygen to different parts of the body. So they're what take oxygen when you breathe it in. They take oxygen from the lungs, deliver it to tissues, and allow everything else to function. But we also have white blood cells, and we also have platelets. So white blood cells, for the most part, are responsible for immune function, fighting off infections, fighting parasites, helping the immune system stay healthy. And then there are another type of cells called platelets, which are actually little fragments of cells, but they are primarily important in clotting. So they prevent, if you do get cut, they stop the blood loss. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of proteins as well in the plasma, but those get pretty complicated, and most of the transfusions don't have, we're not usually giving them, except for one major protein called albumin, which is the largest amount of protein in the blood is albumin, and it supports a lot of different body functions.
Now, collectively, when you are either taking a blood donation or you are giving a blood transfusion, do you refer to the blood that would just come out of, let's say, my arm if I were to give a donation, is that what you call whole blood?
Yes, that's okay. A whole blood transfusion is we take the blood, it goes into a bag and goes then almost immediately usually into the patient.
Okay, so sometimes I understand certain people maybe who, I know there are different blood types and we'll get into that, but sometimes people give donations of just one particular type of thing like plasma or platelets maybe. Does that happen with animals too?
Most of the donations in dogs and cats are actually donations of whole blood. Okay. We do make those separate products, but what we usually do is take whole blood from a dog and then separate it into those components, plasma or blood, and store them separately so that if a recipient needs just plasma, they can get just plasma or another, and we can then get maybe two transfusions out of every unit we collect.
Very good. So can you describe to me, and this may be a little bit complicated, the process by which the blood gets the oxygen from the lungs, the cells, is blood moving through the lungs and it picks up the oxygen, what, atoms? How is it at that point?
There's a molecule on red blood cells called hemoglobin, which has, iron's a big part of that, but the hemoglobin molecule is what really attracts oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so when blood, there's part of the circulation is to supply the lungs with blood, and it's very close. There's a very thin barrier between the air that you breathe in and the blood that courses through the lungs. And so that hemoglobin has a really high affinity or stickiness for oxygen. And so the oxygen very readily wants to cross from the air into that hemoglobin, and then the red cell holds on to it until it gets further into the body, and then it can release that to places that have less oxygen. It sort of diffuses back off.
Okay. And how does it – I mean, I'm sure it doesn't really know, but how does it know where it needs to do that?
It mostly based on concentration. So when we breathe air in, we have there's about 21% oxygen in that air, and that's higher than what's in the blood that's returning – that's going to the lungs. And so it goes from that high percentage to a lower percentage. And then when it gets into the rest of the body, there's an even lower percentage in the tissues at that point. So it just goes from high concentration to low concentration generally.
Okay. So I think then that I have a pretty decent idea of how the blood works. Now, with animals, animals, of course, would have smaller volumes of blood than human beings would, right? But nevertheless, animals who experience some sort of probably trauma, I imagine, mm-hmm. might encounter a circumstance, an unfortunate circumstance in which they lose some blood. Now, I don't know particularly how much blood is in a person, and I certainly don't know how much blood is in, say, a dog. So let me ask you, and you know, let me know if it varies by size. I suspect it does. You know, how much blood is in, say, an average golden retriever or something like that, and how much could that golden retriever stand to lose before it's in jeopardy?
That's a really good question. It does definitely vary by size. In cats, we have a fairly similar size range, but when you talk about dogs, you know, we range from a 5-pound chihuahua to 150 or 200-pound mastiff. And so the amount of blood really varies. So a tiny little 10-pound dog would have about a cup and a half total of blood in their system, whereas a mastiff actually has about 5 liters. Mm-hmm. And a golden retriever would be somewhere in the middle at around 2 liters. They can lose how severely affected they are actually depends on the process by which they lose that. So if they do have a traumatic event, anything over about 20% of that, they're going to really feel. They're going to okay. We're going to notice that they're have lost that blood and are feeling the need to breathe faster or breathe harder or be affected by that. If it's gone really slow, they can actually lose a lot more because their body has time to adapt. Okay. And so something like a bone marrow disease might have a lot more loss of those red cells before you noticed it.
Now, this is critical because rapid blood loss, as you say, since the function of blood is to provide oxygen, that's one of the main functions, losing a good volume of blood quickly inhibits the absorption of oxygen by all the vital organs of the body.
Yes. Yeah, that's the main reason that the blood loss, that's the main thing you'll notice in a patient that's losing blood. Actually, the first sign is they'll start to breathe faster or breathe harder.
And with a blood loss, with a circumstance that causes more gradual blood loss, the blood is able to somehow regenerate itself in time to stave off this blood, oxygen deprivation?
It's actually usually on the other side. So the body just gets more used to not having that oxygen around, and so it can adapt to that a little bit more. There's still a point at which you have to have so much oxygen to function well, mm-hmm. and there comes a point where those animals will get sick. But they just are – it's kind of like if you train at high altitude there, you're going to breathe in less oxygen, and so you get more used to functioning with less oxygen in the air.
So presumably a dog who lived in the Himalayas then could lose if that dog were, say, to move to Florida and live at sea level, could lose more blood and not really notice it as much.
Probably. It depends still a little bit on the speed, and there is some – if they're a totally normal dog, they'll actually compensate at high altitude by creating more blood. So if it's depends a little bit on situation, but there is definitely a function of how fast it happens and how well they're able to adapt.
And the animal body, just like probably the human body, has some sort of means by which it knows how much blood it needs to create.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that? Where is the system by which the body knows how much it needs to create?
That's actually a really good question and a little bit complex. There's a couple major hormones that are related, and the most common one that people think about is a hormone called erythropoietin, or EPO, which has been in the news for blood doping scandals. It's also used commonly in chemotherapy patients if they need to produce more blood cells. So that hormone is one of the main things that tells the bone marrow it needs to make more red blood cells. And it's generally produced in the kidney. So the kidney is one of the major organs that senses how much oxygen it's getting and then can tell the rest of the body it needs more or less blood at any given time. There's a few other hormones that are also involved, but that's the main one is out of the kidney.
Okay. And then you mentioned the marrow, and I've heard that bone marrow has an important function related to blood. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah. So bone marrow is actually where most of the blood cells are produced. Almost all of them come out of the bone marrow. There are different stages, so it produces different stages, and then when they're finally mature and ready, they get released into the blood. And so that's where we get the red blood cells and platelets and the vast majority of the white cells as well.
Now, let's talk then a little bit about what sort of circumstances would cause an animal to need a blood transfusion.
Yeah. The most common blood transfusion is for oxygen carrying capacity or red blood cells. And the term for not having enough red blood cells is anemia.
Okay.
And so if we have a patient come in and we detect that they're anemic or have low red blood cells, the first thing we think of is there are three big categories of reasons why that could happen. So that one is that they're bleeding somewhere, and there's lots of reasons that could happen. It could be traumatic. Sometimes they can actually get into things like rat poison that cause bleeding problems. So, or they could even, if they're under surgery or something, they could have bleeding and need blood. So one big category is blood loss. There's a second category, which is production. So the marrow we just talked about that's producing red cells can have problems. If there's a cancer or a lack of that hormone that tells it to produce red cells, it'll stop doing that. And so through different bone marrow diseases, it'll just not make enough red blood cells. And so that's another category we call production problems. And then there is another important category in dogs, which is called destruction. And there are diseases by where the immune system actually starts to destroy the body's own red blood cells, or certain infectious diseases will do that too. And so we look for, they're not really bleeding, but they lose their red blood cells to destructive processes.
This will take us slightly of a tangent here, but can you tell me what could cause such a condition and what treatments are available if that should happen?
Yeah, that condition, we call it, the main one where the body's destroying is immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, or IMHA. It's a term, unfortunately, a lot of people probably are familiar with it, but the underlying cause can be a number of different things, and we know in about 50% of the cases we can identify what has actually caused that reaction. There are about 50% of those cases where we never really figure out why the immune system got turned on. It's largely an abnormal response. The immune system is supposed to identify bacteria or viruses or foreign proteins or substances and attack those. But sometimes those foreign proteins or what the immune system thinks is a foreign protein can look a lot like proteins or substances that are actually on a red blood cell or a platelet or one of our own tissues. And if the immune system essentially gets confused or over-exuberant, it can start attacking its own cells. So when that happens, some of the most common mistakes from the immune system standpoint are either proteins or things from cancers or infections. And so a lot of times, those are the things we're going to focus on looking for, different types of infections or different types of cancers.
So a cancer then, which I understand will affect a pretty substantial portion of dogs, particularly as they age, these cancers can cause blood problems that may need remedied somehow?
Yeah, it's not a common complication of cancer. So although cancer is a pretty common problem for dogs at some point in their life, the majority of them aren't going to have this destructive process.
Okay.
From the flip side, when you have this destructive process, that's one of the diseases we look for. And then I kind of forgot to answer your question about treating, but there are treatments for it as well. One of the main treatments is transfusions, mm-hmm. if they need those. So we replace the blood cells that have been destroyed as needed until we can stop the immune system. The other part of treatment then is we give medications to try to stop the immune system from acting. So immunosuppressives are a big part of that therapy.
And is that a way to treat all kinds of anemia?
No, that's fairly specific for immune-mediated destruction. So we would probably not use those same kinds of immunosuppressives if we had a dog that was bleeding for some reason or had a production problem.
Okay. Now, then back to a previous question, which was, about why you might need to give a transfusion to a dog. So I can see that there are several different reasons. Let's talk, though, about what I suppose, unfortunately, is one of the more common reasons, and that would be a trauma. Do you find that trauma is a primary reason that animals need blood transfusions?
Yeah, that's one of the more common reasons, particularly because it usually happens very suddenly. And so they, even if they don't lose as much blood, they're going to feel it a lot more. And so in hip, you know, dogs, unfortunately, and cats can, if they're running in the streets or something, we have a fair amount of animals that get hit by cars. And so that's a very common reason to need blood transfusions.
And when these animals come in, it is obviously an emergency and time is of the essence. What happens, if you can maybe give me a step-by-step kind of process, if that's possible? You know, an animal comes in, let's say it has been hit by a car, or maybe a dog has been attacked by another dog and has lost some blood. Where do you join the team that is maybe working on the various other traumatic aspects of that injury? I mean, I imagine we are talking about open wounds. Maybe we're talking about potential for infection. Maybe we're talking about broken bones. Where does the blood part come in?
The blood part's going to come in fairly early if there's a significant need for it. So it's very case dependent, obviously. But any animal that comes into the emergency clinic, one of the very first things that happens is what's called a triage assessment. So almost immediately, an animal's they're going to have a basic assessment that looks at how they're breathing, how their heart's beating, what their gum color is, and signs of anemia would include very pale or white gums, a very fast heart rate, very fast respiratory rate. And so, if we see those things almost immediately in any case that has a trauma, there's going to be a test called a PCV in total solids. We can run it immediately, essentially. And so that test will get run. If their level of red blood cells is very low, they're going to that kind of triggers the process of getting a transfusion. And we do try to move that process pretty quickly. So that if an animal really feels, if the anemia is severe and they really need to get blood, that can happen very, very quickly. So as soon as we find that out, we try to make sure that the blood we're going to give is compatible. So we do some basic testing to make sure it's safe to do this, but we can do all of that in a pretty efficient time manner. And then we have blood actually available almost immediately to give to that animal. So we can start that process within minutes. That would happen a lot faster than something like fixing a fracture or dealing with the wounds, actually. The blood would be a much more immediate need to stabilize them.
I see.
And help them be ready then to get those things. They can get them simultaneously. Sometimes you have blood and other people working on other parts.
Now, let us say that an animal that is in the operating room is receiving oxygen, perhaps via a mask. Does the blood's ability to transmit oxygen increase in efficiency by receiving more direct amounts of oxygen? That is to say, you said that air has, 21%,
21%. Yep.
Oxygen. But if a dog were to receive, say, straight oxygen, does that allow it to have the oxygen move more freely in the blood, even if there's a lower volume of blood?
It will certainly help. So getting oxygen, if an animal's anemic or is having trouble getting oxygen, increasing the amount that they breathe will help a lot. Mm-hmm. But the red blood cells are really a critical part of that. And so it will only help to a limited amount unless you have enough red blood cells to really aid that process. It helps a lot more if they're also getting blood cells at the same time.
Okay.
So if an anemic animal is having trouble breathing, certainly oxygen's better than not getting oxygen, but it's not going to be anywhere near as good as getting red blood cells.
Can you tell me a bit more about the test that you perform on that animal when it arrives at the ER?
Sure. There's a couple of different tests that we would do before a transfusion. One is to look at the blood type. So just like people have blood types, dogs and cats also have blood types. Dogs and cats are pretty different in terms of their blood types and their responses to transfusions. But that's one of the things we'll look at, is what type of blood do they have, to make sure that we're using we try to use compatible blood whenever, you know, in every case. And then there's another test we can do, which is called a cross match, which is a direct comparison of their blood and a better prediction of what their blood would do with the specific unit of donor blood that we're going to give. So we actually can do a lab test and mix those parts of each of those samples together and make sure that there's not an incompatible reaction.
What differences could there be between the two types of blood, besides the obvious one that you mentioned, blood type? And we can get into blood types in just a minute if we could. But you say that you can do a direct comparison. What are you looking for in that test?
With the cross-match test, with the direct comparison, what we're really looking for is, does either one of the samples have a reaction, an immune reaction against the other? And the way we detect that is that the red cells can either be destroyed or can stick together. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're looking for, is a sort of immune reaction that might not be predicted just by knowing the blood type.
I can see why it would be bad if the red blood cells were destroyed, but what about sticking together?
That's also a sign of an immune attack, and so that can trigger the sort of destruction. It just might happen later, so we still want to avoid that. It's a sign of antibodies against something in the blood.
So what destroys it? The white blood cells?
Eventually, yes. So the sticking together is primarily a protein function, but eventually that will tell or trigger white cells to come along and destroy that.
Okay. So let's go back to blood types. I know that most of us have heard about A and B and O are different blood types. I don't know how many there are altogether with human beings. I don't even know. This is terrible. I don't even know my own blood type. But I've donated blood before, and they must know my blood type.
They do. Yep. It's important in people, and it's definitely important in dogs and cats. They're actually very different, though. So cats have, and there probably are blood types or blood groups we don't even know about, but from a comparative standpoint, cats are actually somewhat similar to people in that they have an A type and a B type and a very, very rare AB type. But the really important part about cats is that, similar to people, a type A cat has pre-existing antibodies or proteins that would react against blood from a type B cat, and vice versa. So if you give type A blood to a type B cat or the reverse, you can have really severe reactions to that. Dogs are a little bit different. They actually have a lot of different blood types. There's over 13 different types of blood in dogs, but there's only a few of those that are important clinically. Actually, we can only test for about half of those on a regular basis, and only one of them is very important. And even that one, in most cases, dogs don't have those naturally occurring antibodies. So the very first time they get a transfusion, they can get blood from almost any donor. We tend not to do that. We'd prefer to minimize their chances because later on they'll be sensitized to it. But at least the first time, it's safer.
Why is that? Why is it the first time their body will accept it and later on their bodies will not accept it?
Because they can still have – so if they get a blood type that's not their own blood type or a universal blood type, there are proteins there that aren't in their own body. And so they will – the immune system will recognize those, and it will – it's kind of like being vaccinated. It will make new proteins or new antibodies against those proteins.
I see.
So if you try to give that same blood – 2 or 4 weeks later or a year later, you could run into problems.
I see. So, but the first time, it's just never seen anything like it. So it'll just take it and worry about building up that immunity later on.
In almost every case, yeah.
Okay. And that happens less in cats or more in cats?
That never happens at all. So cats have to be typed because if they're all born with an immune response against the other blood type.
Okay.
So they're... It doesn't matter if they've ever been transfused or ever seen blood before. They have a response against it.
Now, are the names A and B and O, are those just sort of arbitrary or do those stand for anything?
They're – in dogs and cats, they're arbitrary essentially. And cats have the AB system. In dogs, we actually organize it by a system called DEA or dog erythrocyte antigen. Erythrocytes are red blood cells. So it's just a different way to label them, but they don't stand for anything in particular. They don't tell you anything about the particular molecule that you're interested in.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. My name is Dana Hill, and I'm talking today with Andrew Specht from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about blood transfusions. We're going to take a quick break. We welcome your calls, though, to the show. Of course, this is a call-in show, and I regret that I sometimes... forget that because I get carried away. But the number is 352-392-8989. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back with more Animal Airwaves Live after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. My name is Dana Hill, and I'm talking today with Dr. Andrew Speck from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. We're discussing blood, and in particular, blood for the purpose of transfusion. Animals sometimes need blood transfusions, as we have heard. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 352-392-8989. Now, Dr. Speck, getting back a little bit to the various blood types. So you say with dogs, there are over a dozen blood types, very specific blood types, though you say that you have, you can tell the difference between what, six, or it's only six or so even.
Yep.
How did that work?
Yeah, there's a lot of different blood types, but only a couple have ever been shown to cause reactions. And
okay.
Of those, there's really one blood type that we particularly care about as likely to cause a reaction, and it's called DEA 1.1. And so that's the main one that we determine on a case-by-case basis, is 1.1 positive or negative.
Okay. And as you said, with cats, it's a bit more important because cats need to get the exact right type of blood. Now, I understand that with human beings, there is something called a universal donor. Does that exist in animals as well?
There are universal donor dogs, or what we consider to be universal donors. There's no such thing as a universal donor cat because, like we said before, each cat already has a reaction to the other blood type. So, there's no such thing as a cat that you can get blood from that can give to any other cat. There's the very rare blood type AB, which can receive blood from any other cat. They're the only ones that can do that.
Okay.
But they only make up about 0.2% of the total population. But there's no cat that can give blood to any other cat. There are dogs that we feel it's safe to give blood to any other dog. And the requirement for that is they have to be negative for all of the testable blood types, except there's one exception called 4, which almost all dogs are positive for, so it doesn't really matter whether they're positive or negative. They tend not to have reactions to it. But they have to be negative for all the other blood types that we can test for to be considered universal.
With something as time critical as blood transfusion, these tests that you perform to determine the type of blood must be able to be processed very rapidly. How does that work? What do these tests look like?
There's a couple different versions of the test, but they're all very quick tests. So blood typing, at least for 1.1, is performed. You can perform it on the table in front of you. There's a little card that you can look for the sticking together of those red blood cells, or there are gel columns now, which are nice, and you can essentially put the blood in it and you see whether it stays on top or drops to the bottom. It's a very simple test to read, very quick, so that you can tell for sure whether you're going to have whether you have the type that you think you have or not.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we run the other test, the cross-match test, is that even though there's universal donors, there's still a slight question of individual variation. And so we know about 13 blood types in dogs. We can't test for them all, though. And there's probably still some blood types out there that we don't know about. Just a few years ago, they found a new blood type in dogs. It seems like we should know them all by
right.
now, but they're still finding some new ones. And so the cross-match ensures that even if they have the same type, we make sure that there's not going to be some unusual reaction. And that's still a pretty quick test. We can do that in a couple tubes in front of us within a few minutes.
Now, are these tests the sorts of tests that your regular veterinarian can perform at his or her office, or is this the kind of thing that has to be done at an animal ER like the one at UF?
The tests and the transfusions, it does depend a little bit on the clinic. Some clinics are set up to do this, mostly emergency clinics. Certainly, hospitals like ours are well equipped for it, but a lot of veterinary clinics can and do test for transfusion compatibility and give transfusions.
And with the test that you're doing quickly there on the table when the animal needs it, that test gives you a result. And the next step for you is to what? Go into your blood stockpile and grab some?
Basically, yeah. Once we know what type the animal is, if we have a dog and we know that they're 1.1 positive, then we can go and we might not even need a universal donor at that point. We can get blood from a 1.1 positive donor and We can then cross-match against three of the units in our blood bank, make sure they're all compatible, and as long as they're compatible, we can start the transfusion.
Now, I'm interested in what sort of testing is done on the blood that has been donated before it goes to an animal for any sort of infectious disease. I know that it's a very critical component of human blood transfusions and donations, that blood is rigorously screened for all manner of infectious disease, probably, but notably, obviously, for humans, something like HIV would be something very critical to test blood for. Does that have to happen for animals? Is there infectious disease that animals can transmit via blood transfusion?
Absolutely. And that's been a major area of concern over the years. So there, recently, in the last few years, actually, one of the major colleges, ACVM, which is a College of Veterinary Internists, which I'm an internal medicine specialist, they got a group of experts together to try to determine exactly how animal donors should be screened. And there is a set of guidelines now that any blood bank or blood donor program can look at and use to know exactly what and how to screen for. And it's a pretty big variety, just like in people. Certainly some of them are similar. Cats can get a virus called FIV, which is very similar, and that is one of the things that gets screened for. Some of the screening is very simple, things like heartworm testing and some base, you know, things that every dog should really be screened for. And then there are some rare infectious diseases, but things, particularly things that might be carried by ticks or fleas, a lot of those kinds of infectious disease have to be screened for. And because of that, we actually have to also make sure the donors are on, they're screened initially, but they're also continually tested and provided with medication to help prevent any of those diseases from developing.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT FM. My name is Dana Hill, and I'm talking with Dr. Andrew Speck from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. Our number here is 352-392-8989. Let's talk then about the donor program that you have for dogs at the College of Veterinary Medicine. It's something I didn't even realize existed, before quite recently. Has it been around for a long time?
Yeah, we've had a donor program for a number of years where we have mostly pet owners who, you know, were clients who've come to our clinic, and they understand that blood can be helpful or life-saving to other dogs. And so they volunteer their dogs to serve as blood donors. The dogs certainly live with them as normal pets that you can't pick them out on the street or anything. But they come in periodically, usually once every few months, and donate some blood and then go back home.
Let's get back to that, but let's go to the phones right now. We've got a call from Bill. Bill, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Go ahead with your question, please.
Okay, I was going to talk or ask about, looks like my dog's been diagnosed with myasthenia gravis. And I just wanted to find out what that means. I know a little bit about it, but for the long-term or short-term consequences of this disease in my dog.
Yeah, Dr. Specht, can you speak to that?
Yeah, myasthenia gravis is I'm sorry to hear about it, but
yeah.
That's an interesting disease, certainly. It is a disease that affects the what's called neuromuscular junction, so the connection between the nerves and what they're telling the muscles to do. And so it's generally, for those who don't know, it's generally characterized by progressive weakness, and it will progress to the inability to stand or walk for any length of time. And so what you'll see is an animal won't be able to walk for even a few feet, and then they'll get really tired and stumbly. Myasthenia gravis can be caused by a number of things. And so what it means for the long term really depends on the individual case and the individual dog. And so it's very hard to predict how your dog is going to do. A lot of it depends on response to medications. And there are a couple, depending on the cause of myasthenia, we also have some different options. It's pretty hard to say exactly how any individual is going to respond to that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bill.
I'm told that the difficulty could be that she will not be able to eat unless she's in a vertical position because she's also been, what's it called? The megaesophagus is a problem that it may be, and well, it is myasthenia gravis related, I guess. But it just seems very difficult to keep a dog from, I mean, I can feed, she feeds twice a day, and that I think I can control that. It's going to be the other times. And I'd be quite honest with you. The test, we've sent the blood off for the test, and I don't really know that's what it is, but it sure looks like it because she has some muscular or some motor skill interruption that has shown up a couple times. And I was wondering about that. Is that going to get worse if it is indeed myasthenia gravis? I know I'm dumping a lot of questions on you, but they're coming to me as I'm talking to you. And
yeah, that's no problem. It's a little bit hard to predict on a patient that I haven't, you know, examined or seen. If it's affecting the rest of the system, then it a lot of whether it will progress depends on response to medication, really. And so there are some cases that will respond very well, and we can stop that progression or reverse it. But there are also cases that just don't seem to respond. And if it's one of those, unfortunately, it does tend to get worse. The megaesophagus doesn't always get better, even in the responsive ones. And so that's something that you may have to deal with. The vertical feedings are important, and you're right, it can be really difficult to keep a dog doing that or prevent them from getting into things when you're not there. There are some ways to do that. There are some people, you know, we can buy them stands or have them kind of stand on a little set of stairs, or even there's a
Bailey
depending
chair.
How big the dog, the Bailey chair, which is a little device where you kind of sit them up on, you know, so they look like they're standing on their back, but they're supported. And that can work really well to keep them in that position. Every dog being different, some dogs can tolerate megaesophagus reasonably well as long as they're kept in that upright position. There are also some that even in that position, they can still have problems. And so if they continue to have problems, there are a few other things we can do. We can find kind of the ideal food texture that works for them. Some dogs will tolerate we make canned food into meatballs or kibble better than liquid foods, and some dogs will be the exact reverse. Well, they'll tolerate it. We actually make their food into kind of a gruel or liquid, and that seems to work better. So it's a matter of kind of trial and error and working with your vet to find exactly the right solution for those. There are even cases where if the only sign of myasthenia is megaesophagus and the rest of the body is relatively normal, we do have some patients where we've treated them by essentially bypassing the esophagus and using feeding tubes. Normally, we don't like to use feeding tubes long-term in dogs as sort of a life support, but this is one of the few diseases where I certainly have some patients that have had they were born with a megaesophagus that have had feeding tubes in for years as a way to get around the regurgitation or vomit, essentially a vomiting-like action that is the dangerous part of a megaesophagus.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Bill, so much for the call. I sure hope that things work out with your dog. We have, looks like, another call from another Bill, this time in Hernando. Bill, go ahead with your call. You're on Animal Airwaves Live.
Yes, I was just wondering how you get the blood. I mean, you know, we always see these, you know, blood mobiles and stuff. Where do you get the blood for the animals?
This is a great question, Bill. Thanks for bringing us back to this. So Dr. Specht, you have a blood donor program there, and as you were just saying, the pet owners for dogs will bring in their dogs, and out of the goodness of their hearts, the dogs donate blood.
Yep. And yeah, a lot of times it's people who've had a need for blood transfusions in the past who kind of become aware of this. But we do have a lot of, and a lot of staff and vet students know about the need for blood transfusions. So we do have a lot of people who work at our practice who their dogs are our donors. But we also have a lot of, clients out in the community who bring their dogs in for donations. It is a lot like the blood mobile in people where, you know, we're asking for donations and people respond. Not every dog can donate blood. There are some criteria. We require bigger dogs. They have to be over 50 pounds. They certainly have to be a dog that's we don't want to stress the dog out with this process. So it has to be a dog that's comfortable in the hospital environment, even for short periods of time and doesn't mind the procedure. The procedure is pretty quick and easy. It's not a particularly painful procedure in any way. We're putting a needle into their blood vessel and drawing blood. But certainly some, a lot of Labradors and Goldens are completely comfortable with that. Other dogs might get a little stressed, and so we you know, that's not our goal. We don't want to stress any dog out with this. So we have the clients will bring their dogs in and donate blood. In return for that, there are some benefits to being in the program. So dogs that are blood donors in our program do get annual exams to make sure that they stay healthy. They get the infectious disease screening that we look at. They get some regular blood work to make sure that all of their systems are in good shape. And certainly every time before they draw blood, they get a quick exam and a quick screening to make sure that they're in good shape. And then along with that, we provide them with some medications to make sure that they stay heartworm free and avoid flea and tick problems.
So there is a pretty good benefit for pet owners who get their dog in on this program. And of course, the benefit to other dogs who may need the blood is there. But dogs who donate don't do it for their entire lives.
Right. There is a cutoff. So we tend to take dogs between they have to be adult. So we want them to be at least 1 or 2 years old. And they tend to stop donating by the time they're about 8. So we try to keep them in that, you know, healthy middle age range. And we don't want to have them go through this for their whole life. So it's usually a period of a few years and then they go off and live their life.
And with these dogs, where do you like to put the needle to extract the blood?
The easiest place in dogs is actually from the jugular vein. Dogs are different than people in that sense. That's actually where we draw most of our blood samples for diagnostic testing, but it's also where we draw blood for blood donation. Mm-hmm. They tend to not mind it at all. They actually seem to tolerate that often better than they do from the arms and legs, like where mm-hmm. where people get blood drawn from. So we usually use the jugulars.
And how much blood do you take out each time?
These are fairly big dogs, and so we take out an amount that's very similar to human donation. They give about each donation is about 450 mils, which is a little bit less than a pint of blood.
Okay.
So it's the blood bags are very similar to what you've seen if you've ever donated blood.
But for a dog that has maybe 2 liters of blood inside, which maybe is for a bigger dog,
yep.
You're still talking about a pretty
high
proportion.
A little bit over 10% usually mm-hmm. of what they have. Blood volume is also a changing volume. So when we take out blood, we're also giving them fluids to replace that.
I see.
So we're not going to take all of that and not put anything back into the vessel. They are getting fluids as we're doing that. So the total number of red cells goes down, but not to a point where you wouldn't know that a dog had given blood if you saw them right afterwards.
And then when you take this blood from a dog, and then you presumably do the test that you were describing earlier, and then that blood goes where? Into storage somehow?
Yep. Dog blood is generally stored until needed. So we will take that unit of blood, and we'll actually separate it, like we actually briefly touched on that before, is we'll tend to take that unit of whole blood, and unless it's going to be used immediately, we'll separate it into a product called packed red blood cells, which are just the red cell part, and plasma. And that way, if a dog only needs plasma, we can give them just the unit of plasma, and if they only need the red cells, we can give them just the red cells. So we get two products out of every donation that way.
And how long can you store blood like this?
The red blood cells should be stored generally for less than a month. They can live for longer than that, but we generally will use them up within about 30 days. Okay. And most of the time it's faster than that. There is a need for blood products in dogs.
Right.
So even with – we have about 70 or 80 donors that are all donating blood on a pretty regular basis, and we go through all those units in a fairly short time frame.
Do the 70 or 80 donors satisfy the need overall, or is it – critical that more people do this program?
Right now, that is mostly meeting our need. There are times when we need a little bit additional blood products, and there are blood banks in the country that we can order from if we need to. There are also some very specific blood products that have unique characteristics that we might have to order. But for the most part, that's meeting our need. We're certainly seeing more patients and more need over as the years go on, and so this program keeps expanding. At one point, the goal was to have 100 donors, and I think still potentially eventually working towards that.
Now, you tell me that your system for cats is a little bit different.
Yeah, our system for cats is different. We don't need as much cat blood, and so if we were to just store cat blood, there would be times when we'd use it all up immediately and times when it might sit for over that 30-day period and end up getting thrown away. And that's not a good use of that resource. So and cats tend to not like coming into the clinic from a home environment as right. much. We actually have a colony of cats that live in the hospital, near the hospital. They have a nice room with all sorts of trees and toys. And
right.
It's actually one of the places the staff like to go watch them because they're mm-hmm. pretty fun. But those cats will live with us for a couple years. And during that time, they will give blood on an as-needed basis. So if we have an emergency, a cat comes in and needs blood, we will draw the blood right there and give you generally a whole blood transfusion to that cat.
So really, essentially, those cats live in Kitty Fun Camp, and then one day a cat comes in who needs a blood transfusion right away, and then you find the cat in your kitty camp who has the right blood type, right?
Yeah, in our colony, all of the cats are A type. So in the population of cats, even though it's really important that the blood type be matched, well over 99% of the cats actually out there have type A.
Ah.
So it's very rare that you get a type B cat.
Okay.
So it wouldn't really do any. If you had a type B cat, he might live there for years and never donate blood. And it would take, you would have to test 100 cats to find your one B donor. So for the most part, we have type A donors in-house, and we are almost always dealing with type A recipients. On the rare occasion that we might get a cat that needed type B blood, we would generally order that product.
Okay.
There are a couple of the very large commercial blood banks do have type B blood available to order.
Now, is there no such thing as a synthetic replacement for blood products?
That's a really good question. There actually was a product that we had available for a number of years that was just the hemoglobin part of blood. So we talked about that's the molecule on red blood cells that attracts or collects oxygen. And there was a product made up of just big hemoglobin molecules, which was nice if you couldn't type or weren't sure what you were dealing with. Unfortunately, the market for that wasn't very big. And so the product isn't available right now.
Yeah. Now, if you could, you know, leave our listeners, particularly ones who, you know, may find themselves in the unfortunate circumstance of needing a blood transfusion for their pet, or someone who is maybe interested in participating in the program, if you could leave them with any sort of advice or words, what would that be?
Well, certainly anyone who's interested, if you have a big dog, you know, who you think would be a good donor candidate, you know, mild dog, and you want to see if they're eligible for that program, you can certainly call our hospital. And that then hospital number is 352-392-2235, probably call during regular business hours if you're just interested in this. Or you can go to our website, actually, which is vetmed.ufl.edu. And if you go to the hospital part of that, there's a section you can follow the links from hospital to services to blood bank. And there's a whole page actually of frequently asked questions with some contact information at the bottom. So for someone who's interested, I would say the website's probably the easiest way to sort out initially whether that makes sense. If your animal needs blood, probably the key things are, you know, we've certainly come a long way in safety, and giving blood to dogs and cats is generally a pretty safe procedure. The risk of side effects or problems with that is very, very low at this point. And so as long as we're testing and making sure that it's safe to give, it's a pretty well-established procedure by now. So I would say that, you know, that it certainly is something. If they need to get blood, you just want to make sure that you're at a place where they can do that. So if, you know, if you have a dog that's hit by a car and they're going to get blood, just make sure, you know, we know what the situation is as far as availability.
Well, Dr. Speck from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Oh, no problem. It was great.
My name is Dana Hill. I want to say thank you to Richard Drake. I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey and Steve Seip, of course, as always. You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. We'll be back with another episode next week.